This is the Get Better Everyday podcast with Matt Gouget. Actionable advice from real-life superheroes who, just like you, are in relentless pursuit of the best version of themselves. Whether you're just getting started or have been at it for years, my hope is that this podcast injects you with some positive energy to continue doing what brings you joy. Join me as I interview the best of the best in business, sports, and life. Let's grow together.
Hi, I'm Alex.
And I'm KJ.
And we're the producers of the Get Better Everyday podcast.
Do you like podcasts? Well, then hit us up. IkePodcastNetwork.com. We'll help you build your show.
All right. Get Better Everyday podcast with Matt Gouget. I'm excited to have my friend Ryan Renteria on. We probably first crossed paths 3 decades ago. I was thinking about that this morning. I don't feel like I'm even 30 years old, let alone... You know,
making me feel old.
So early 90s, Sac High. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Wall Street. We'll talk about the Pacers. We'll talk about the book, Lead Without Burnout. Diving into this, man, there's so much stuff to talk about. Maybe just give us a snapshot. You know, who is Ryan Renteria? What are you up to and where have you been?
Sure. And thanks for having me, Matt. I'm thrilled to chat about any and all topics that might be helpful to your audience. And I sort of joke that, but I mean, I guess it's serious. I've had 3 different careers at this point. Right now, my current career is I'm an executive coach, and I specialize in helping CEOs, founders, managing partners. And I'm basically taking my experience from my prior 2 careers of studying and advising leaders from Wall Street and the NBA to help these senior leaders optimize their growth. And so the first decade of my career was on Wall Street, largely in the hedge fund business, managing money. And the second decade of my career was as a Moneyball analytics advisor to the Indiana Pacers. And so taking the lessons from studying, advising the various CEOs I was looking at backing when I was on Wall Street, and then working with a completely different set of leaders, NBA executives and coaches, and trying to apply that now and help folks on their journeys and from a personal and professional growth perspective.
Yeah, I love it, man. And so maybe, you know, I know how all of that leads to writing a book, Lead Without Burnout. Maybe give the audience kind of a feel for, you know, what's in the book, why you wrote the book, and, you know, who can benefit from Lead Without Burnout.
Sure. I think if you're a CEO or a senior leader and you read this book, you'll think, gosh, this was written specifically for me. However, if you lead even a team of 1 or 2 people, 90% of what's in the book is going to be highly applicable to you. So the whole origin story is really that I had seen successful outcomes working with CEOs, but it's a very small scale. There's only one of me. I have no desire, because I love work-life balance, to build a massive team myself and train and outsource. I coach a select number of people myself. And so I wanted to have an impact on a larger level, and I felt that the book was the best way to do that. And so I wrote this book, and I think if you look at the title, Lead Without Burnout, you might think, okay, this guy's going to write a lot about the importance of sleep and meditation and exercise and things of that nature. But everybody already knows that those things are important. It's how do we actually create the time for those things? And that's what this book is really about. My core thesis is it's about the culture you create with your team that allows you to attract top talent, learn to trust and delegate to that top talent, which is going to free you up for the types of activities that you know are important from a work-life balance and a mental recharging perspective, and to spend more time engaged in deep strategic thinking about what you need to do at a high level to take your unit, your group, your team, your business to the next level over the next 5 years.
Yeah, I love it, man. As somebody who leads a small team, like this stuff resonates with me. And I'd love to, because like you said, man, everybody kind of knows it. And I think like it's public knowledge. Like, hey, you can't go all in on work, neglect your family, and expect to have, you know, a marriage that lasts or be a good father if you're right. Absent, right? But let's try to maybe get tactical. Sure. Even for somebody like me who's got a small team, and like, I get it, right? Like, yeah. I've got to be present with my wife. I've got to carve out time for that. You know, I want to be a good dad. I want to be at every single baseball game, and I want to coach basketball. What are some tactical things that you can give to the audience for, you know, how to actually achieve that? Because like, sure. yeah, I know that's right. But I'm also grinding and hoping that, you know, I can keep up with inflation and send my kids to college and do right. all the other things.
Right. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think, you know, I would start with in chapter one of the book, we laid out two specific exercises. One is the values and visions exercise, where you answer a very small, simple set of questions on what you want for yourself professionally and why, what you want for yourself personally and why. And then the second exercise is a Wheel of Life. And you can Google Wheel of Life exercise and pull it up for free off the internet. And mine is a slightly tweaked version of it. But really what you do is you see how you are currently stacking up on the 8 most important areas of life. And then you sort of look at those two and say, well, are they in conjunction with one another? Did I lay out a case in my personal and professional values for X? And then when I do the Wheel of Life, I find out that I'm X minus 5 on that area. And so it's really about figuring out what are the 2 to 4 areas that matter most to me, and how do I become an 8 or 9 out of 10 in those 2 to 4 areas? Because the biggest problem is perfectionism. I want to be a 10 out of 10 in everything, the best at work, the best dad, the best husband, the best volunteer. And it's just impossible. It's just unrealistic, this perfectionism. And so that leads to a lot of guilty feelings. And then we end up falling short in important areas. And so really laying out what matters the most to me and how am I going to focus on those things? And so let's say somebody's already at that spot. I already know that I want to be a 9 out of 10 in these 3 areas. Well, tactically, the next thing you have to do is you have to create this culture with your team that allows you to attract really good talent that you feel that you can trust and delegate to free you up to go to that baseball game or be home early for dinner a few nights a week or whatever it is. And so that's really what the book is all about. There's several chapters in there about creating a culture of trust, psychological safety, mental health and well-being. And then there's a whole chapter in there about hiring and attracting and developing those great people. And then you have to have that personal growth journey of learning to get out of the weeds of your business, even though that's what got you there, controlling, micromanaging, being deep in all the details, getting out of the weeds, trusting and delegating to them. And this newfound freed up time for yourself is either going to be spent on, it's going to be spent on some combination of the Wheel of Life, mental recharging, and spending more time on this deep strategic thinking about high level initiatives to get your team to the next level.
Yeah. When you talk about the book talking directly to people, like that resonates with me. And exactly what you're talking about is what I want to dig into, because as seeing it, you know, from the inside out, as somebody who was a one-man band, grew a team, and over time, that's how businesses evolve, whether it's mortgage or real estate or any business for that matter. And you even talked about it in the book. And I think this is the value of reading a book from somebody who's been somewhere and done things. You've made mistakes, and so you put it out there. Hopefully people don't make the same mistakes. I made the same mistakes as you, where it's so hard to give up control. And I think you talked about Wall Street 07 or 08, like, because you're not able to give up control, you know, the business hits a ceiling.
That's
and,
right.
And then your personal life suffers. I know that all too well. So I'd love you to talk about that, because I think that's where people in their head, they're like, okay, I want to be 10 out of 10 in everything. Or even if they're realistic and they want to be 8 or 9 in everything. But if I let go of any control in business, that's going to plummet. And then I'm over here with my focus and attention on being the best family man in the world, and this is going to plummet. I know it's not true. You couldn't have told me that years ago. The 2007 version of you probably didn't understand it as well as you do today. So talk a little bit about that. And if you want to give some specific examples from Wall Street, that'd be cool too.
Sure. It's a natural inclination for all of us to feel like the second I give up the slightest amount of control, things are going to spiral out of control and everything is going to go downhill. And it's just simply not true if you have the right people and systems in place. And so in 2007, I did have a great team in place. And I would say, okay, go build these financial models on these companies. But instead of trusting them, I was in there triple checking all their numbers, inputting the numbers myself. And you just can't scale that way. It's just impossible. You just can't create the time to do that and to be thinking more strategically. And so I think the first is getting over the guilt hump, right? So it doesn't mean, okay, all of a sudden I'm going to go from working 60 hours a week to 20 and I'm going to be off playing, you know, video games all day, right? You're doing things that are going to actually be additive to your long-term growth, profitability, et cetera, by, you know, being more present with your family, getting better sleep, eating healthier. You're going to come in significantly more energized during the day. You're probably going to be a nicer boss to work with and not have these short fuses. And rather than being so deep in the weeds, you're going to actually be able to spend time reading about trends in the industry, thinking about what acquisitions do I want to make? Where are customer preferences changing? What technology shifts are going on and how can I implement them in my business? And so ironically, what got you here was being deep in the weeds and controlling. Ironically, letting go of those things and dedicating less hours to them will actually raise your long-term profitability. But again, the key to all of this is making sure that you have a great team in place and being able to trust them and delegate to them. And I would suggest starting with baby steps. Once you've gone through, like I said, we have a whole chapter in the book on hiring, from interview questions, due diligence questions, and things of that nature. Once you have those folks in place, you start off by giving them, trusting them with something that's a 1 out of 10 importance level. Here, go run with this, right? And they come back and they do a good job and you feel validated that you interviewed and you nailed it so far. So now you give them something that's a 3 out of 10. And over time, it's baby steps until now you're able to give them a 7 out of 10, an 8 out of 10, a 9 out of 10 in terms of importance. And some of the CEOs I work with joke, well, at some point you wonder, am I even needed? Is there even, because I've got this great team that's executing for me. Is there any purpose in me being around? And of course, you're going to be focused on strategy and things of that nature. But those are some of the things I would suggest, because like I learned on Wall Street, you can't just be deep in those weeds and controlling. You're never going to scale your business. You're going to hit a wall. You're going to hit a ceiling and everything around you is going to suffer personally and professionally.
Yeah, that's so great, man. And you're so, so right. Something you said, I want to pull out for the listeners. What got you here won't get you there, right? And so most of us, myself included, like just grinding hard, and whether it's a sales position or anything else, like brute force got me here. But from here, any sort of scalability in any business, brute force will only get you so far after a certain amount of time. And I really like what you said too, because I think about me and my personal business and, you know, things I've done right, things I've done wrong. It was so hard for me, Ryan, so hard for me. I remember 19, 20, 21. Like it was just a great time to be alive in the mortgage industry. We were scaling. I know a company that I remember talking to their CEO about going from 250 million to 10 billion. And so it's like scaling 40X. Like that is hard, right? And that's brute force certainly isn't working for that guy, right? Like he's got to have trust in people. But what you said, I think, is really great because it's actionable for anybody at any level. You just start small.
Yeah.
And you say, listen, like here's our standard operating procedure. If we get this question in, here's your response, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to detrimentally affect the business if that goes wrong, if something goes wrong. And then incrementally, it becomes more and more important where, you know, I'm still working on this, to be quite honest, where I tell my team, like, every time you run something by me and say, is this what, here's what I think, what do you think? I always agree with you. That's an indication that, like, we're aligned and you know this, you know, side by side for 5 years. You've got the answers. And so I guess selfishly, I want to ask some questions about my personal business. You know, how do I continue to foster that environment where it's not because I'm like, I don't want to do the work. I want to be left alone. Right. But it's to your point, like I want to work on vision. I want to work on scaling. I want to work on stuff that's going to move the business forward and help everybody. So how do I, you know, continue to, I guess, pour that confidence into team members that, like,
sure,
you're capable and you know, you probably don't need to run all this stuff by me. Just roll with it.
Right. Yeah. And I think it comes down to, there's several different prioritization exercises I walk through in the book that I think would be helpful. And one is the Eisenhower matrix, where you basically divide your to-do list into four quadrants, whether it is urgent and important. And that's something that you're going to spend a lot of your time on now. Urgent, but not important. That's something you can easily delegate to somebody else. Not urgent, but important is something that you can put on your calendar for a month from now or 2 months from now or 3 months from now. So you're postponing the anxiety around it and you're dealing with it then. And not urgent, not important, just get that off the list. Get that off everyone's list. And yeah, if there's something administrative or logistical that has to be done, then assign it to somebody lower level on the team, right? So that's one way to attack your to-do list. Another way to foster a slightly different way around this in learning how to trust folks and show that you believe in them is dividing things into three different buckets. Once you've sort of done this matrix and you say to yourself, okay, what is something that I can just, what are the tasks that I can say, you know what? I trust you. I believe in you. You can run with these things and you make the decision and you don't even have to involve me. And then the second bucket is this sweet spot of you go and run with the first 90% and you come back and you bring me in for the last 10%, where you walk me through your reasoning, your recommendation, and I still get that stamp of approval and to get to play some role in it. And then lastly, what is it that you're just going to spearhead yourself, but you're still going to involve them to some extent? So these are two different ways to kind of approach your to-do list and think about how you can foster that trust in them and free up your time. And I think it's constantly reiterating, I'm doing this because I have high expectations for you and I believe in you and I believe you can execute on this. And it's really amazing because there's two forms of guilt that often come from this perfectionism and not willing to give up control or step back at all on the work front. And that's, are my competitors going to move past me? And is my team going to think, oh, this guy's off, you know, just living a great life and we're in here grinding for him? And interestingly enough, if you look at the real intrinsic motivators of employees, it's not compensation. Yeah, of course, you have to be, you know, in line with market, but it's about ownership, autonomy, responsibility over challenging work, challenging projects, where you can achieve great things on your own and not be micromanaged. So if you actually execute this and you bring in great people and you show them you believe in them and you trust and you delegate to them, starting with baby steps and in a methodical way with these prioritization lists, they are going to want to absolutely kick ass for you and do everything possible for you. And if you're using some of that newfound time on vision and strategy and driving your profitability higher on a 3 to 5 year basis and everyone's benefiting, once again, they're going to be more than happy to execute for you.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, I think somewhere in the book you talked about, you know, being part of something bigger than yourself. And,
that's right.
And, you know, as a leader, sometimes I forget that. So I'm sure other leaders forget it too, that, you know, 70 grand to 80 grand might not move the needle at all as far as like personal satisfaction for somebody who's working for an organization. But like, hey, Jen, you helped this initiative, which drove this. The overall, you know, business grew by X percent. And like, that was something that you led the charge in. And so it's like being part of something bigger than you, having an impact on the organization as a whole, most times is for most people going to be, you know, a bigger driver than, you know, a compensation boost of 10 or 15%. So
that's right. And most people, when they're interviewing for jobs, don't realize that that's going to be the case. They're focused entirely on the comp number. And then 3 months later, they're miserable because they didn't do enough due diligence on the boss who's a micromanager. And they're not values wise aligned with where the boss wants to take the unit. Right. So if you're in a job switching situation, pay close attention to how in terms of doing your due diligence on the boss and what the mission and the vision is and things of that nature, more so than a slight difference in comp versus something else you may be looking at.
Yeah. I love that conversation too. And it's a great point. Like as an employee, like remember that like the best culture, being part of something bigger than you, having impact at 110, is that going to be better for your life than horrible work culture 120, right? Like,
right.
Right. I think people probably don't think about that. And I'd be curious your perspective, you know, working with a bunch of leaders, how would you communicate that in, you know, a setting where you're trying to hire somebody?
Yeah.
Communicate that, like, hey, you're going to this, trust me, like we might be 112 a year and they might be offering you 127, but this is a better place to work. Obviously, you know, I think in interviews, people talk about, you know, the company culture and things like that, but communicate right. that specifically because it matters. But to your point, people don't realize it, that it matters to them.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm glad you asked that because I dedicated a whole chapter to this in the book, Cultural Bylaws. And in terms of the feedback I've gotten on the book, people have really highlighted that one in particular. And what's interesting is there's many different benefits to it. So I basically lay out this cultural bylaws document where you sit down and with input from your team, you lay out the why am I getting up every day and doing what I'm doing in this business? The what specifically am I trying to do, and the how, what are my strengths, my identity, my philosophies that are going to help us get there, and what are the lessons learned or mistakes made so that I can review those before making any major decisions. And so this document not only is fantastic for you strategically to set the strategic tone and the strategic direction for your team, and if people are working remotely and you have your constituencies ranked in this document, then they can refer to it and make decisions without having to bother you. It just makes for more concrete priorities. This is also a phenomenal recruiting tool. When you're in interviews and you're interviewing and trying to compete for top talent who are interviewing elsewhere, you can show them this document and say, we don't have a mission statement that's a bunch of fuzzy buzzwords on the wall. Here's a comprehensive document that lays out exactly what we believe in, what we're trying to do, what our values are. And if you believe in those things, then come be a part of something bigger than yourself and you will be fulfilled. And I think that's one way. And another way is just to sell yourself as an innovative boss who's done the homework and studied the importance of empathy and genuine caring about their people and how much people value specific compliments, recognition, thank yous, gratitude, and how you've also studied process versus outcome. And so if something goes wrong and they're responsible, you're going to look at the situation and figure out, was it a mistake in that person's process? Or did they suffer an unlucky outcome, a bad beat in poker, or something where the odds should have been X and it just went Y, right? And so I think that if people know that they're coming into a situation and believe that their boss is going to be innovative and prioritize mental health and well-being through the way they treat people and lays out the specifics of that, particularly in a document that everyone in the organization is following, that's going to be extraordinarily powerful compared to, well, I'm interviewing this other place and they're offering me 3% more and the boss says he's great, but I don't really know how to trust him and I don't know what they're all about and I'm having a hard time getting a hold of former employees, and so I'm risking a landmine in that other situation.
Yeah, I love that stuff. And so, I mean, it's important on both sides, right? And there could yep. be a, you know, lead without burnout and then a, you know, follow or work within the organization without burnout as well. Because it's the same thing, right? Like an employee who's, you know, in an environment where they're not appreciated, they don't feel like they're part of a bigger thing and it's just like a daily grind. Like there's plenty of burnout I see from people who you know, work in all kinds of different jobs. So I want to switch right. gears a little bit because I can't not talk about the NBA. As a big basketball fan, sure. You know, both of us are Sacramento guys. So despite you working at other organizations, hopefully your heart still lies in Sacramento. Yeah. but, you know, from Wall Street to working for the Pacers, I'd love to hear, you know, how that transition happened. And then I just want to ask you questions about, sure. You know, stuff that I love, analytics and yeah. sports and whatnot. Yeah. So. What led you from Wall Street to the Pacers?
Yeah, so it was 2010. I was 30 years old. I had had a really good run in the hedge fund business. I was burnt out and I walked into my boss's office and I said, I'm not leaving you for another firm or another deal. I'm leaving and I'm going to go volunteer with kids in perpetuity. And he gave me a hug and he said, that's sweet and that's great. but you're 30 years old, you're obviously going to be, you're going to want intellectual stimulation again in the future. And, you know, let me know if you want to come back into the business. And so I took 2 years where all I did really was, well, I did a lot of personal things as well, but in terms of day to day, it was really just volunteering at five charities for disadvantaged children in New York City. And I was extraordinarily spiritually and emotionally fulfilled. But he was right. Intellectually, I was bored. I wasn't using my brain, challenging myself intellectually. And so I was enjoying running my own capital without the pressures, the short-term hedge fund pressures. And so I didn't really desire going back into that business. And so I thought, well, what would be a fun gig for me to get some intellectual stimulation and use my skills? And I obviously always loved sports growing up, watching, playing sports. And I started reading about everything I could on basketball, baseball, and football analytics, and came to the conclusion that baseball analytics, a lot of the arbitrage was gone because Moneyball was written in 03 and every front office had multiple Ivy League PhDs squeezing out the last 50 basis points of alpha. And that football was completely at the opposite end of the spectrum, where you had guys who had been old school coaches that had been doing things one way for 40 years that had no desire to hear anything on the analytics front. And I felt like basketball was this perfect sweet spot in the middle, where some early adopters had had some success, and coming out of the crisis, hedge fund and private equity guys were buying teams and installing evidence-based processes and decision-making and tools. And so I built a set of algorithms for evaluating players from the G League, the Euro League, the NCAA players, and the NBA, and met with a bunch of NBA owners and GMs. And the Pacers created this wonderful situation where I could be a remote advisor to them from my home office in New York City, and help the front office with trades and free agent signings and draft picks, and help the head coach and his staff with opponent tendencies and working on our own strengths and weaknesses and things of that nature. And so it was a dream come true being able to play that advisory role for 9 years before I decided to leave to start my my CEO coaching business.
That's awesome, man. I'm curious, how many NBA teams have somebody with, you know, that sort of role, data analytics and research type stuff?
Oh, at this point, every team has multiple people. So when I entered the league in 2012, I would say about half the teams had, you know, one to two people, and the other half had zero. And when I left 3 or 4 years ago, everybody had somebody. Some teams had double digit number of analytics dedicated employees, and probably the smallest team in the NBA would have been three people at that point. So it's probably even bigger now. So, I mean, it's just so much on the biometric and health and performance front, in addition to everything else going on the basketball court, and just the data sets that they're getting now from the cameras that are in the arenas and things of that nature. So it's just, you know, it's one tool in the toolbox, and it's a great tool to have.
Yeah, I love it, man. Yeah, as a self-proclaimed math nerd. Did you have Miss Nishizaki in high school?
I did indeed. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It see, was, we go way back.
The slow way game and the fast way game.
Oh, man, she was great. She was great. Cool. Well, you know, I really, really appreciate your time. Is there anything left that you want to say to the audience, or any last parting words besides, you know, I'm going to highly recommend Lead Without Burnout. I've got this copy. I've got that copy. I always buy two copies, because when I read a book and it resonates with me, I always have somebody in mind where I'm like, you know what? This would be, Bill would love this book. And so I don't know who it's going to be yet until I'm done, but someone's going to get gifted a copy of Lead Without Burnout. Parting words?
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, you can get the book on Amazon or any online seller. All the proceeds go to mental health charities like Mindshare Partners, that focuses on mental health in the workplace specifically. And I hope people get a lot out of the book. And my website, if anyone wants to learn more about what I do in terms of executive coaching, is thestretch5.com. And yeah, I just wish the best for everyone on the mental health front. And on learning to have great balance and as a whole human, not just as an employee and a leader.
Yep. Awesome. Thanks, Ryan. I appreciate you, brother.
You bet. All right. Take care.
This is Matt Gouget. Just wanted to give you a quick thank you for listening to the Get Better Every Day podcast. Hopefully you're inspired to go out there and get better every day. If you could, please do us a huge favor and leave a 5-star review if you found any value in this. Share it with your friends. Again, thanks for listening and go out there and get better every day.